the anti-war, anti-justice movement, or pro-justice movement, excuse me, broadly speaking, is that this is a community that says, if we want to end gun violence and mass shootings in schools within the states, then we must also be willing to not provide a war criminal 2,000-pound J-bombs to decimate every school and university across Gaza. If we want to expand access to healthcare, then we also must be willing to hold to account any government that bombs or decimates every healthcare facility across all of Palestine or across Lebanon. These are the morals and the values that we have. And this is the principal position that we have taken. And this is not just a position that is popular here in the city of Dearborn, but if you look across the polls, across this country, you have seen that the center of America has moved on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And what has yet to be had is the center of the two major political parties in this country to move on the issue as well.
Abdullah Hammoud, I want to thank you for being with us. Mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, just declined to meet with Donald Trump in Dearborn over support of Israel's assault on Gaza, but has not endorsed Kamala Harris, though encourages people to go out and vote. There are apparently six third-party presidential candidates in Michigan. Tune in on election night. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, November 5th, for our Democracy Now! Four-hour election special from 8 to midnight Eastern time on Wednesday, 8 to 10 in the morning a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Turn your ballots in and turn your radio on for KBOO's live election night coverage on Tuesday, November 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. We'll discuss local, state, and national issues as the results roll in with perspectives on what matters most to all of us in the Pacific Northwest. That's KBOO's live election night coverage on Tuesday, November 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. It'll be fun, right?
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KBOO Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Vice Presidential Candidate Tim Walz shares inspiring last words at the tail end of the campaign trail.
California sues a city near Los Angeles for a temporary ban on homeless shelters.
And researchers at the University of Washington look into how misinformation affects elections. Good evening. Happy Election Eve. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 4th, 2024. I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. One issue that's been critical in elections across the country is reproductive rights, including abortion and IVF. Vice presidential candidate Tim Walz stressed that message as he spoke to voters gathered in La Crosse, Wisconsin, Monday.
Lives are at stake. We're seeing it across the country. Maternal mortality rates in states like Texas have shot through the roof. A story comes out every single day because of Donald Trump's abortion ban that put 20 states under this ban. Our daughters now, those people you're thinking of, those loved ones that are in your minds right now, they have fewer rights than their mothers and grandmothers had. They are more at risk than they've ever been. But here's the good news. When we get that Senate, we get that House, we elect Kamala Harris, they will send over the restoration of Roe, making reproductive rights enshrined into law, and President Harris will sign it.
The Harris-Walz campaign has been running on the issue of reproductive rights in swing states. The campaign has framed the abortion bans as an assault on American values like freedom and democracy.
We are not going to stand there and allow them to talk about freedom that takes away our freedoms.
Both Harris and Walz spoke extensively on the issue during each of their debates. Former Representative Liz Cheney, a historically anti-abortion Republican, endorsed Kamala Harris in early September. She said the current state of abortion bans was not suitable and needed to be rethought. During the rally in Wisconsin, Walz appealed to traditional American values.
This is going to be, and there are billions of people around the world, can't imagine having the freedom to gather in a room like this to determine the future of how we want to be governed. A future that either goes backwards, is divisive, dark, and angry, or one that is hopeful, unified, inclusive, that gives us the rights that we know 250 years of patriots have kept this American experiment alive.
Vice President Kamala Harris emphasized that same messaging of unity in her closing argument last Tuesday.
Norwalk, California, a city just southeast of Los Angeles, city council voted to ban new homeless shelters and emergency housing in August. After receiving a warning from California's housing officials that ban was illegal, council members voted to extend the moratorium to last a full year. California Governor Gavin Newsom filed a lawsuit today against the city for violating half a dozen housing laws. Specifically, Norwalk is out of compliance with AB 1893, a California housing law that streamlines affordable housing in suburban areas. Nicknamed the Builder's Remedy, the law has led to large housing increase developments and proposals in Santa Monica and Beverly Hills. Rob Bonta, the state attorney general, said in the news conference, quote, "We would prefer that Norwalk simply follow the law, but they have chosen. It is their choice. They decided willingly, intentionally, and deliberately to violate the law," end quote. Norwalk City Council members say homeless shelters and supportive housing pose a threat to homeless safety, public safety. The ban applies to laundromats, payday loan businesses, liquor stores, car washes, and discount stores as well. California awarded Norwalk with $29 million for housing and other resources for people struggling with homelessness. Norwalk faces a mandate to plant over 5,000 new homes by 2029, but so far is issued permits for only 3.5% of that goal. Norwalk City Councilmember Rick Ramirez said, quote, "We're fully aware of the consequences, but the fact is we have to have local control. Why is it always Norwalk that's the dumping ground? Where are the other cities in their efforts to combat homelessness?" End quote.
Online rumors and falsehoods are increasing as Election Day nears. Researchers at the University of Washington have been monitoring how these rumors could impact the election. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Researchers at the University of Washington are watching closely as rumors and false claims swirl ahead of Election Day. The University of Washington Center for an Informed Public has been following and analyzing misleading rumors popping up online. Many false claims about election interference have focused on Pennsylvania, the largest swing state in the 2024 presidential race. Kate Starbird, who co-founded the center, says many rumors start with a kernel of truth, such as an isolated case where a voting machine didn't record a vote correctly.
When people are saying the machines aren't working, this is true. It starts out as a rumor, but eventually becomes just fact. But it gets twisted into this narrative that it's an intentional effort to disenfranchise certain voters, and that's false. So we can see that sort of intentionality is one place it gets twisted.
Starbird says when incidents become misleading rumors, they can obscure the remedies. She also notes that isolated events are sometimes extrapolated to make it seem as if they're widespread when that's not the case. She says the twisting of evidence is part of an attempt to undermine the results of the election. Last week, fires were set at ballot drop boxes in Vancouver and Portland. Stephen Prohaska is a graduate research assistant at the Center for an Informed Public. He says people on the right and left already had a frame in place for interpreting events like these that involve blaming the other side.
Oftentimes, they're improvising based off of these events that no one really knows to predict. Like, we don't know that that's going to happen, but they have these frames set and are able to cue audiences on how to interpret that. And this is bipartisan.
Starbird says a diverse group of actors, including influencers on social media, content creators, and organizations, are loosely collaborating to define what the narrative of the 2024 election will be.
We don't know what it is. We'll have to wait for the election results. But the improvisation has been going on all along, and they're certainly very active right now, and they've got a very participatory audience.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Donald Trump escalates violent rhetoric against the press. Vice President Harris aims to reassure Michigan's Arab Americans angered by the war in Gaza. And a respected poll shows an unexpected lead for Vice President Harris in solidly red Iowa. With more on the story, is Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
With just one day until the election, former President Donald Trump is repeating his use of violent rhetoric, this time towards the media. Trump lamented the need for bulletproof glass to protect him at a Pennsylvania rally, but said it's okay if members of the press get shot. Media staff have been physically attacked at Trump rallies. Vice President Kamala Harris campaigned in Michigan, home to nearly a quarter million Arab Americans. To those frustrated she hasn't done more to end the Gaza war, Harris repeated her support for a two-state solution and again said the civilian deaths are unconscionable.
We need to end the war and we need to get the hostages out. And as president of the United States, I will do everything in my power to achieve that end and a two-state solution.
A well-regarded poll shows Harris with a slight lead over Trump in deep red Iowa, thanks in part to older and independent women. Most found that stunning, but not Sarah Janes with the Rural Democracy Initiative. She says nearly 8 in 10 Iowans are against abortion bans and support better child care for working families.
They're very focused on working people as kind of the heroes of the economy and concerns that impact working class people.
The Trump campaign dismissed the poll as a meaningless outlier. Voters in 8 states will consider constitutional amendments to ban non-citizens from voting, which is already illegal in federal elections and almost never happens. VoteBeat reporter Alex Scherr says the conspiracy theories, like those he's hearing in Wisconsin, could lay the groundwork for post-election protests.
The allegation that non-citizens are voting en masse is as baseless as it's ever been, but the use of the talking point has undoubtedly increased substantially.
Project 2025, the conservative roadmap for a second Trump term, calls for passage of the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. Parkland school shooting survivor David Hogg says forcing cities and states to recognize a permit from any other jurisdiction, no matter how lax, would gut local gun control efforts. He calls it a life and death issue.
We have to address that because the future of our country is dying every single day.
The future of public education in New Hampshire might depend on who's elected governor. Democrat and former Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig opposes the state's private school vouchers, while Republican former U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte wants to make them universal. Megan Tuttle with the National Education Association says the program is designed to dismantle public schools and diminish the teaching profession.
It doesn't help anybody who might want to go into education because they would be going into a profession where they're going to be attacked. They're not treated as professionals.
Polls show the race is a dead heat. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A new Rural Democracy Initiative poll shows the most important issues for rural Iowans as they head to the polls tomorrow. The economy's impact on workers, threats to democracy, and abortion top the list. The poll saw Republican Donald Trump's lead among likely voters drop from 26 to 18 points since a similar poll conducted in March before Democrat Kamala Harris entered the race. Mark Moran reports.
Poll results indicate Iowa's rural voters say the economy, jobs, and inflation top the list of important issues for them in tomorrow's election. 37% of Iowa's population lives in rural areas. Nearly 400,000 Iowans have already cast ballots, and the rural vote could help determine the outcome of the presidential election in Iowa. Rural Democracy Initiative's Sarah Janes says rural voters want elected leaders to make lowering costs and increasing wages for working people a priority, not reducing taxes for wealthy people or deregulating corporations.
They're very focused on working people as kind of the heroes of the economy and concerns that impact working class people. Rural people and small town folks are more likely to be working class. About 70% of rural folks are working class.
The Rural Democracy Initiative poll also found nearly 8 in 10 rural voters say they're against banning abortion, similar to numbers in March. Jane says aside from high-profile issues like abortion and inflation, rural Iowa voters support candidates who will focus on policies that support local workers.
people want to make sure that they have the tools and opportunities to create a good life for themselves and their families, and that shows up in their support for childcare and health care.
Other recent polls show Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump in a dead heat in the presidential race. I'm Mark Moran for Iowa News Service.
Arkansas election officials say early voting numbers are down compared to 4 years ago. They believe more people voted early in 2020 because of the pandemic. Frieda Ross shares details.
Election officials in Arkansas say fewer people cast early votes in this year's general election than in 2020. They say more people voted early 4 years ago because of the pandemic, but University of Arkansas political science professor Andrew Dowdle says the state is known for its low voter turnout. He says only 62% of voting age people are registered to vote, and the state doesn't try to reach people in rural areas.
They've made it so that if you are a high probability voter, it's very easy for you to vote. We've not done a good job in terms of reaching out to those people who are lower probability voters.
Dowdle says the larger counties have multiple early voting locations, but in smaller communities, early voting is limited to the courthouse or county seat. He adds Arkansas is also known for rejecting mail-in ballots in large numbers, especially in rural counties with a large African-American population.
It's going to be heavily scrutinized. You're going to have to provide a pretty strong rationalization, and then there's going to be a number of efforts that are going to be made. The burden of trying to get in a mail-in ballot is just a lot higher than other states.
Early voting was heavy in Benton and Washington counties in northwest Arkansas. Dowdle blames the overall low voter turnout on complacency.
People kind of talk about Arkansas and say, well, no, Arkansas is not a red state. It's just a state that doesn't vote. But most polls have shown that there's not a lot of variation between voters and non-voters. It would move Arkansas a little bit from dark red to light red.
The polls will be open tomorrow from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. If you're in line before the polls close, you will be allowed to cast your ballot. I'm Frieda Ross, Arkansas News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News on the eve of the election. Stay tuned after this newscast for news in depth. We're speaking with the author of the new book, Remaking the Space Between Us. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, LTAR. Let's talk about race. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy and cloudy with a high of 52 degrees. Today in history, California voted to pass Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage in 2008. Earlier that year, the Californian Supreme Court ruled that a state ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. The ban was soon overturned, and same-sex marriage was made legal nationwide in 2015. The quote of the day is from gender nonconforming author, performance artist, and activist Alok Ved Menon. In their memoir, Beyond the Gender Binary, they write, quote, "We want a world where boys can feel, girls can lead, and the rest of us can not only exist, but thrive. This is not about erasing men and women, but rather acknowledging that man and woman are two of many stars in the constellation that do not compete, but amplify one another's shine," end quote.
Control of the United States Senate could hinge on the Montana Senate race and Native American voters. A resolution to recognize rare animals as sacred beings is getting drafted at the United Nations Biodiversity Conference. And on this day in 1791, a coalition of Great Lakes tribes crushed U.S. troops at the Wabash River in western Ohio. With those stories and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez.
Control of the U.S. Senate could hinge on the Montana Senate race, and Native Americans could very well decide the outcome after racist Indian tropes became a centerpiece of the contest. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Most polls have three-term Montana Democratic Senator John Tester down to his Republican challenger, Tim Sheehy. But Tester's campaign has been redoubling its get-out-the-vote effort, including on the state's reservations, where many of Montana's estimated 70,000 Native Americans live. That makes them a crucial voting block, and many are mad after recording surfaced of Sheehy mocking attendees of Montana's 105-year-old Crow Fair celebration, saying they're drunk at 8 a.m. and throw beer cans during the parade. Tribal elders have called on the former Navy SEAL to apologize, which the moderator relayed to Sheehy in their September debate.
The reality is, insensitive. I come from the military, as many of our tribal members do. You know, we make insensitive jokes and probably off color sometimes, and I'm an adult. I'll take accountability for that. But let's not distract from the issues that our tribal communities are suffering.
And you can say, look, I'll take responsibility. But, you know, apologies matter, and how you treat people matter. And if you treat them with disrespect, other people will disrespect them. So like I said to begin with, you're a big guy. Just apologize.
When National Native News asked Interior Secretary Deb Haaland about demeaning tropes being spread by political aspirants in this election, she said it's time for candidates like Sheehy to read up on Native American history.
I hope that people who say things like that will educate themselves, because if they're running for office, they need to be educated so that they can be effective leaders.
Haaland told us Sheehy's comments are personally painful.
You know, when people say really offensive things like that, they lack a knowledge of the history of our people.
Tester's campaign says it's dropping more than $1 million on tribal outreach this year, and they're hoping Indian Country comes through and sends him back to Washington on Tuesday. For National Native News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A rare white bison calf was born in Yellowstone National Park last summer. Now, a resolution to protect such animals has strong support from tribal communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Mertzbach tells us why.
Phil Two Eagle is Sechangu Lakota. He believes the white bison calf, even rarer because of its black nose and eyes, fulfills a tribal prophecy. It could be both a blessing and an opportunity to reflect on our relationship with nature.
We need to get ready for something that's coming. It means that we have to pray.
And Two Eagle believes more white animals could be born around the world. So tribes and conservation leaders have banded together to get the animals recognized as sacred internationally. They hope to work through the United Nations Biodiversity Conference to make the recommendation in the coming years.
The white animal is the messenger of some type.
A Lakota spiritual leader has dubbed the Yellowstone bison Wakangli, which means return sacred. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Mersbach.
And on this day in 1791, a coalition of Great Lakes tribes crushed U.S. troops at the Wabash River in western Ohio. Led by Miami Chief Little Turtle and Shawnee Chief Blue Jacket, the Native warriors advance in a crescent formation against the troops, killing 600 in 3 hours and causing the rest to flee in panic. Deaths on the Native side were estimated to be as few as a couple dozen. It's considered the biggest victory of Native Americans against U.S. soldiers, more so than the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
Oregon's environmental movement lost one of its champions last week. Bob Salinger died at age 57. He was the executive director of Willamette Riverkeeper and Bird Conservation Oregon. KBOO's Barbara Bernstein and Oregon State Representative Con Pham spoke about Bob and his legacy on this morning's episode of Locus Focus.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian.
I need to take a few moments to honor the passing of a dear friend and environmental leader, Bob Salinger, who died suddenly on Halloween. For over 30 years, Bob has been a regional fixture advocating and fighting to protect our rivers, wildlife, forests, and communities from environmental and social degradation and injustice. First at Bird Alliance at Oregon, and for the past 2 years with Willamette Riverkeeper, where he became executive director, Bob was a voice of clarity, passion, and unblinking vision. One of his many gifts was his ability to effectively weave together environmental concerns, progressive politics, and a feisty pragmatism that achieved results. Bob was a frequent guest here on Locus Focus, and we'll miss his voice, his energy, energy and his humor. The best we can do is take up all the lessons we've gained from working with Bob and get busy continuing his essential work. So, Khan, I know you had a relationship with Bob, too, and I was wondering if you wanted to mention a little bit about what he meant to you and the work that you've continued to do.
Yes, thanks, Barbara. I will always remember Bob. He was one of the early folks to get involved in the coalition for the Portland Clean Energy Fund. I was working at APANO at the time, and it was really important to us as communities of color-led organizations to partner with environmental organizations, but at the same time to have really clear understandings of who was in the leadership of the campaign. And Bob made it really clear that he understood the need for frontline leadership, but wanted to offer the capacity of his organization, often more privileged members, and really just was so consistent in bringing his wisdom, his strategic mind, and also his humility to the work. And I continue to just appreciate that about him. As we continue to work together in the state legislature, he was pivotal to helping educate me about the Elliott State Forest issues through its many different iterations, and really every environmental issue that I worked on, and really in Portland, has Bob's fingerprints on it, and his loss is just a devastating loss for our movement.
I was lying awake in bed last night, and I was thinking of all the questions that I was planning on asking Bob, particularly about Elliott State Forest and carbon offsets, and I thought, oh no, I can't ask him. And it's, I mean, I feel that on so many levels, there's so many things that he knew about that the rest of us just kind of scratched the surface on, and to try to find where that repository is, and the only thing that kind of gives me some sense of purpose is knowing that we've got a lot of work ahead of us to fill his shoes.
That's right. I mean, I he had so much respect across from both Democrats and Republicans, just because after 30 some odd years, you know, he was just the acknowledged expert on so many issues that you could really, I really learned the power of just sitting in the one seat and developing that depth of expertise. And yeah, we will miss him.
That was Oregon State Representative Khan Pham speaking with KBOO's Barbara Bernstein about Bob Salinger, who died on Thursday. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley released a statement on Salinger's passing. He said, quote, "His environmental wins, achieved through tireless hard work, grit, collaboration, and compromise, personified the Oregon way. Bob may be gone, but he leaves behind an enduring legacy that is seen and felt in the lands, waters, and wildlife that he strengthened. He is survived by his wife, Elizabeth, and their three children."
A proposed refinery on the Columbia River uses renewable sources like organic waste material, has received criticism for its potential impact on the environment. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality recently collected public comment while evaluating water quality permits for the project. With more of the story, it's Eric Tegedoff.
A project that could bring a refinery to an estuary along the Columbia River is getting pushback from the public. Next Renewable Fuels is proposing a diesel refinery in Clatskanie, Oregon, with a capacity of up to 50,000 barrels a day of fuel. The Texas-based company says the fuel comes from renewable sources, such as organic waste materials. However, Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper says the energy source is not as clean as the company claims, and would in fact be a major source of pollution for the river and nearby homes and farms.
What they heard from the community during public comment was a sharp rebuke, and they heard tough questions that they failed to answer, and that's why DEQ needs to move forward and deny this project.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality was accepting public comments on water quality permits for the project. In addition to opposition submitted to DEQ, 23 organizations sent a letter to Governor Tina Kotek urging her to oppose the refinery. Next, Renewable Fuels says the project supports the state's clean energy goals. But Sears says the company's assertion that the project will be good for the environment are dubious as well.
It's a tremendous negative carbon impact in terms of undermining the state of Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals. And it would be one of Oregon's largest polluters on day one, producing over 1 million tons of greenhouse gas pollution each year.
Sears also notes that Next's own assessment of the project said it will likely impact fish and fish habitat. He says the area near the project is important for the endangered salmon of the region.
Most of the salmon that folks see swimming all the way up the Columbia River come right by Port Westward, and that fact is not lost on the people who are now weighing in with the project and pointing out that there's a major threat here.
Sears says the state should wait for an environmental impact statement from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers before moving forward. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
As scams continue to surge globally, inflicting financial and emotional harm, the upcoming Global Anti-Scam Summit aims to tackle this escalating issue head-on. Trimal Gomes has more on the story.
Online scams are growing in scale and sophistication, impacting millions and creating economic losses estimated at $1 trillion globally in 2023. The upcoming Global Anti-Scam Summit in Arlington will bring experts together to develop strategies to combat the threat. As scams continue to surge, inflicting financial and emotional harm, George Abraham with the Global Anti-Scam Alliance says there is an urgent need to work together.
Now the big challenge is that we have to work across the different industries and across borders because scammers are getting very, very professionalized. And we see scammers usually doing the same scam in 80 different countries. And there the challenge is really putting them behind bars.
The summit is November 12th and 13th. Abraham advises consumers to consult friends and family before acting on suspicious texts or emails. According to the FBI, scams targeting Americans age 60 and older led to over $3.4 billion in losses in 2023, though many cases go unreported. Additionally, the FBI warns the public about scammers exploiting the 2024 U.S. general election for financial fraud. Abraham says scams are becoming the one and two most reported crimes.
We are continuously being bombarded by scammers who are trying to get our identity or our money. And the goal of the summit is to discuss how can we reduce the approaches by scammers, trying to make sure that they are less successful, and in the end, actually trying to really catch the scammers.
The FBI's report found tech support scams to be the most commonly reported type of elder fraud in 2023, affecting nearly 18,000 victims over 60. Investment scams, however, were the most financially damaging, resulting in over $1.2 billion in losses. The FBI says these often involve cryptocurrency schemes that target older Americans' finances. This is Trimal Gomes for Virginia News Connection.
Genetic studies have a diversity problem, as 95% of participants are from Northwest European ancestry. Researchers at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County are looking to